Welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm Lynn Rivers. Last year, the world watched as the so-called Arab Spring blossomed in the Mideast, as Tunisia, Egypt, and later Libya threw off their entrenched and undemocratic leaders. The flame of hope burned white hot. Now, many months later, unrest still exists in Egypt, active fighting continues in Libya, and Syria is engaged in a struggle against a government that has attacked and killed thousands of her citizens. And in the same neighborhood, we have the ever-growing threat of a nuclear Iran, political assassinations, and the end of the U.S. presence in Iraq. Today, we talk with experts about events and attitudes in the Mideast. Joining me in the WEMU studio is Mansour Mwadel. Dr. Mwadel studies culture, ideology, political conflict, revolution, and social change. His work currently focuses on the causes and consequences of values and attitudes of the Middle Eastern and Islamic publics. He's carried out value survey in Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Jordan, Morocco, and Saudi Arabia. He's also carried out youth surveys in Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Professor Mwadel teaches sociology of religion, ideology, revolution, Islam, and the Middle East. Mansour, thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's always wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you.
And joining us on the phone is U of M history professor and respected expert on the Middle East, Juan Cole. In addition to teaching and research, Dr. Cole maintains the go-to website for insight into the tangled relations across this region, informed comment at juancole.com. Welcome, Juan. It's great to talk with you.
It's great to be here, Lynn.
You've both been friends to the show, and it's really nice to have both of you on at the same time. One of the things I want to go back to, the last time I talked with either of you was late last winter, and we were talking about the Arab Spring. And I'd like to really sort of go back and touch base on what's happening, how events have unfolded, what public attitudes are. And the first thing I want to put out to both of you is at the time that the changes were taking place in Egypt, when Mubarak had been removed, there was a lot of talk about the military taking over. And at the time, many people were sort of reassuring. They said, no, the military in Egypt is very well respected. This is going to be a stabilizing effect. But it seems like now, many months after that change, that there's tension between the public and the army. And I'm going to start, or the military. I'll start with you, Juan. How do you see that playing itself out?
Well, there's a three-corner game going on. You have the young left-of-center activists who more or less made the revolution. They were the spearhead of it. Whose main goal is not only to see the end of the Mubarak dynasty, but also to get the military to go back to the barracks and to withdraw from political life, to subordinate the military to the civilian. They are probably a minority. They're a very vocal minority, and of course they've got great street cred because they made the revolution. The Muslim Brotherhood, the right-of-center party that actually came to power in the parliament as a result of the parliamentary elections of last fall, has an ambiguous relationship with the military. Of course, they want it to go back to the barracks, but they're less strident, usually, about the need for it to do so immediately or about the need for it to be absolutely subordinated to the civilian. So the young leftists and the Muslim Brotherhood don't agree on this issue entirely. There are people, of course, in the Muslim Brotherhood who would like to see the military withdraw, especially now that they have a chance to be the dominant power in Egypt, given their performance in the parliamentary elections. The military itself says that it's going back to the barracks in June, not before. But of course, it's not going all the way back. And for the military presented a draft law to Parliament, which would have excluded the military budget from civilian oversight. And I think that's not going to fly. But you can see they're wriggling. The military is seeing what it could get away with.
It's poking. It's poking.
Yes. Right.
Okay. Mansoor, I want to turn to you now. Not only do you poll in this part of the country, you were just there, right?
Yes.
So tell me about what was going on there, and then talk to me about public attitudes with the military in Egypt.
I was at the Tahrir Square at the on the January 25th, anniversary of the beginning of the movement against former President Mubarak. I was just fascinated. That was the side of Egypt that I didn't know existed. I saw a sea of people, hundreds of thousands of people, freely mingling together, men, women, young and old, chanting a slogan. They're generally happy, united, in a common purpose. You get very excited, you know, easily. It is very easy to get carried away with the spirit of the moment. And appreciate the depth of the movement that is going on among Egyptians. I saw even a seven-year-old girl on her daddy's shoulder chanting a slogan and exciting the crowd. I couldn't quite understand in Arabic what she was saying, but she was very effective. If the impressionable year theory is correct, one day she's going to be the president of Egypt. So the common theme of the movement was partly celebratory, I can say mainly, and at the same time there was the anger at the military. They wanted, they were basically united on this issue of the military should go back. They were not critical of the military per se, but at the military leadership. The Egyptians have considerable support, actually, as our survey showed, say, between 2000 and 2011, the popularity of the military spiked quite a bit. Of course, there are a group of Egyptians, particularly those Egyptians whose livelihood is connected to tourism industry. They are quite upset at what is happening, and they do not want the continuation of this movement going on, particularly the
revolutionary movement.
Yeah,
they don't want unrest there.
Yeah, they do not want because it's affecting them. And when I was in Egypt, I had the opportunity to interview a few people. One was one of the leaders of this youth movement who told me that that the youth movement is basically are confused. They do not have any specific agenda. They know what they are against. And one of the reasons that they continue this movement is because that is an issue that they are over which they are united. And also I met with the general manager of the Freedom and Justice Party, as well as the spokesperson of the Salafi An-Nur Party. I was quite impressed by the degree to which they were moderate. Actually, even on women issue, they were more on the defensive. One of the interesting things that they say, I asked them, okay, among these five issues, you know, this movement that is going on, or the Arab Spring, being for democracy and freedom, economic prosperity, Arab unity, against Western conspiracy, this movement altogether are the Western conspiracy, or the, against the Western government. So all of them, without exception, mentioned that this was not an Islamic movement. It was a movement for democracy and economic prosperity. That is something that was supported by our survey in Egypt and Lebanon.
Okay.
So hearing all these three people, you know, particularly from a religious background, confirming that that was not for an Islamic government.
Well, let me, Iwan, I want to turn to you here about, we're talking about that this is, according to Mansoor's polling, that this is a democracy movement as opposed to as an Islamist movement. Yet here in the United States, you hear a lot of talk politically about the Muslim Brotherhood, about the Islamic movement across the Middle East, and it's usually presented as something that Western states should fear. As you look at that issue in that particular neighborhood, how do you see it playing out?
The revolution was not led by religious people. Sometimes they joined in. The parliamentary elections were dominated by religious people in the sense of the people who were elected were overwhelmingly from the religious parties. There's a question as to why that should have been so, because as Mansoor rightly says, the Egyptian public did not see this movement as primarily a religious one, and nor are they in favor of many of the hardline religious strictures that would be championed by some of the people that they elected to office. So why did they elect these people if they don't share their beliefs? And the best answer I can come up with at the moment is that they think that they're not corrupt. That is, the religious parties who won't go on stealing from them, embezzling public money, demanding bribes for government services that ought to be given for free, and so on and so forth. So from an Egyptian point of view, they've thrown the rascals out. And I think it hasn't set in yet that many of the people that they elected to parliament may, in fact, push through laws that do disadvantage women or disadvantage secular intellectuals or the kinds of people who made the revolution may end up being in trouble precisely because of how the elections turned out.
You are listening to The Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU, and today we are talking about the Middle East changes and public attitudes there. Juan, I want to go back to you and ask, though, when we talk about religious parties, is this somehow different from, say, the Christian Democrats in Germany, or the fact that every one of our presidential candidates is making a statement of faith as they run? I mean, does this signal a particular mindset and a particular political agenda, or is this just a larger identification that people make?
I think on the part of the public, it's very much like Bavarians in Germany voting for the Christian Democrats, or like, you know, people in South Carolina voting for candidates that they think are close to religious stances. But from the point of view of the actual parties and their histories, it's something, I think, somewhat different. The Muslim Brotherhood was founded as an anti-colonial movement, initially aimed at pushing back all of the changes that the British made in Egypt when they ruled it from 1882 to 1922. And really, the British went on being highly influential in Egypt until 1956. So it's a movement of authenticity. You know, why should we Egyptians do things the British way when we have our own ways of doing things, including religious ways? And one of its initial goals was the repealing of secular laws made by the British or under their influence, and replacing them with Islamic law as codified by medieval jurists. And initially, the Brotherhood also didn't have, let us say, a strong commitment to democratic governance. Again, they saw parliaments and so forth as something the foreigners brought with them when they conquered Egypt, and they were looking for a supreme religious guide. Over the past 40 years, there's been this tremendous evolution in the Muslim Brotherhood. And so we heard now from my colleague Mansour in his interviewing with the Freedom and Justice Party, that's the political arm of the Brotherhood now, mm-hmm. That they now have bought into parliamentary democracy, and they are about taking care of people and about fostering prosperity. And so it's really not the old Brotherhood of the 1940s, which, you know, did engage in terrorism. It sent fighters to fight the Jews in Palestine. And I think it's that legacy of the Brotherhood in the past that makes people very nervous. You know, has it really changed? Is it evolving to become more like the German Christian Democrats? The Brotherhood says yes, but, you know, the proof is in the pudding. Mm-hmm.
Today we are talking about the Mideast, events that are taking place there, changes and public attitudes to these changes and to these events. My guests are EMU Professor Mansour Mwaddel and U of M History Professor Juan Cole, both experts in the region. I want to turn to you, Dr. Cole. When the Arab Spring started, when first there was the uprising in Tunisia, followed by the uprising in Egypt, there was a sense that the dominoes would fall, that this represented a threat to autocratic governments all across the region. we haven't seen that happen. Certainly in Syria, we've got unrest and we've got fighting, and I'm going to come back to that. But we didn't see it go into the Gulf. We didn't see Saudi Arabia. Do you think that we're destined to see more changes there, Juan, or do you think this was contained into a couple of places?
Well, I think it the governments that had a kind of old-style 1960s socialist authoritarian structure, and which were republics, and developed into presidencies for life and became rather corrupt, that those governments have been falling. And so Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Yemen, the president has had to step down. And Syria is kind of the last of them, but it's unclear what will happen there. And certainly the protests seem to have legs. They've been going on now for more than a year. So it hasn't been across the board. The monarchies have weathered these changes better than the presidencies for life. And I think there are reasons for that. But many of the monarchies are dependent on petroleum and natural gas reserves, and they've been able to more or less bribe their publics into acquiescence. It's cost them. But the authoritarian states tended not to be oil states: Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Syria, and Libya was the big exception there. They didn't have the kinds of resources that could bribe people to accept the status quo any longer. And those states, being republics, were sites of popular sovereignty ideas and political parties and things that, the dynamic is different in them than it is in the monarchy. So I think it would have been a mistake to think that these movements would necessarily roll through all of the countries of the region. But five or six is pretty impressive.
Right. Mansour, as you look at the region and attitudes, do you think this thing is going to be infectious? In other words, are other peoples outside of these countries looking at them and saying, yeah, we want some of that?
Before answering, I would like to add a couple of points to one's comments about Muslim Brothers. I agree about what he mentioned about the
Brotherhood.
The Brotherhood in Egypt. But I would like to add that the Brothers did participate in the election in the wanted to participate in the election in the 40s, but they were barred, and in the second time that they tried to participate in places that they knew that they're going to win, they lost. So it was because of the corrupt nature of the parliamentary politics, and it was dominated by landowners and the merchants, that the Brother turned against parliamentary democracy and if we can call it democracy, and move towards supporting Arab nationalists and the coup. The other issue I wanted to mention is that the Brother, as the Director General of the Freedom and Justice Party mentioned to me, was that they know that they have an image problem in the United States, and I was told that they are planning to establish a public relations office in Washington, D.C., in order to share more freely with policymakers and American public about their views on politics. And they emphasize a lot on development. They said that, the issues of gender relations, Sharia, Islamic law, these are all secondary. What we want to do is to develop Egypt. And so they are bought into whole notion of developmental idealism that was the project of the secular intellectual leaders, if you will. But both, even the representative from the Anur party. Now about the trend, the surveys that we carried out in Iraq between 2004 and 2011, and in Saudi Arabia between 2003 and 2011, and Egypt from 2000 and 2011, as well as in Lebanon, all these surveys show that the trend is toward national identity. The Iraqis showed that the percentage of the public who identified themselves with the nation, defined themselves as Iraqi above all, jumped from 24% or so in 2004. Now it is close to 60%. In Egypt, it is fascinating. Before the revolution, about 80% of Egyptians in all the survey identified themselves as Muslim. Then in the 2011 survey carried out last summer, the majority of Egyptians identified themselves as Egyptian above all.
So what you're saying is that previously people defined themselves by their religious affiliation as opposed to sense of nationalism.
Right. And we ask Egyptian which one is best, you know, a politician who is committed to implementing the laws of the Sharia or a politician who is committed to the national interests of Egypt. So 80% chose the second one. And by the same token, in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, the trends is the same. The religious institutions that lost considerable support, the percentage of Saudis who have great trust in the religious institution has declined significantly. Support for the Sharia declined. And support for democracy jumped from 50 to 70%. Now, 70% of the Saudi public believe that democracy is the best form of government. And one of the interesting features about the change in Saudi Arabia is the disjunction or the gap between the old and the youth section of the population, particularly on the issue of individualism. We ask, for example, what is the most important basis for marriage, parental approval or love? People on the age of between 18 to 25, more than 60% said that love is the more important basis for marriage. People over sort of 45, just the opposite. And this gap expanded between 2003 and 2011. 2003, there was not that much of a gap between old and young section of the population, but now the gap is considerable. I mean, Saudi Arabia, in all likelihood, is sort of, if things changes and favorable conditions emerge, is on the verge of Romeo and Juliet revolution. There has been many cases of young boys and girls communicating with one another and running away from home. Mm-hmm. So then they are captured by the police and they are in difficulty with their parents, with the religious establishment, and with the government. So Saudi Arabia, in terms of the changes in value, is ready for change. The good news is that the trend has been away from political Islam and towards some sort of
a national identity,
say less religious dictation in their personal and social affairs.
You are listening to The Lynn Rivers Show. We are broadcasting here at 89.1 WEMU. My guests today are EMU Professor Mansou Madwell and U of M History Professor Juan Cole. Both are experts in the area of the Middle East, and we're talking about events and attitudes that are unfolding there. Juan, I want to turn to you. Let's talk about Syria a little bit. I mean, we start with Egypt and Tunisia. The Arab Spring blossoms to a broader population. Syrians rise up. It's not quick. It's not easy. We still have fighting going on. You said it has legs, but what do we have? Maybe thousands of people that have been killed in that fight. Talk to me about what's happening in Syria on the ground as best you know, and then I want to talk about a little bit of the geopolitics around that.
Sure. Well, these authoritarian regimes in the Arab world most often were established in the 1960s, and they were kind of the East Bloc or Soviet model light. They weren't communist. They did have some private sector. The economy would be at most sort of 50% in the hands of the government instead of being 100% in the hands of the government. But they had very large public sectors, and one of their purposes in life was to address the discontents in the countryside, because at that time in the 60s, the vast majority of people in these Arab countries were peasants, were farmers, and typically suffered from big landlordism and lack of land, and many of them were landless laborers. So these parties did land reform and typically created rural middle classes that were then loyal to the regime, and that was their backbone for a lot of time, for a lot of the period since the 60s. Well, in the last 20 or 30 years, these countries have become majority urban, and so that you once did something nice for rural people no longer matters. And the parties, being in power for a long time, became very corrupt, and then there was pressure on them to liberalize, to privatize the industries, and that created opportunities for relatives and cronies of the president to do insider trading of various sorts. And so they became increasingly unpopular. And then they don't seem to be very good any longer at doing things like providing irrigation water to the farmers. So the Syrian revolt began in the small town of Dera in the south of the country near Jordan and seems to have been primarily a water protest, that the government just wasn't getting them the water they needed to grow their crops. Then, other populations have taken up the protest, which are more urban, like in Homs and Hama. But it's been an authoritarian regime, the Ba'ath Party in Syria. It's a one-party regime. It's a secret police regime. So, the intellectuals and the educated people, of whom there are quite a lot, mind the curb on freedom of speech, the tendency to get arrested and punished, even tortured if you speak out. But then there are social discontents. A lot of these cities where the protests are happening have seen an influx of rural workers into the urban areas. The economic downturn in the world since 2008 has thrown a lot of them out of work. And so there are employment protests. But I think as the regime responded to these protests, which had many roots, some of them were about water, some of them were about jobs, some of them were about a desire for a political opening. The regime responded brutally. It just brought in snipers and tanks and attacked people. And of course, that angered the population. And so the Syrian government has been provoking a serial feud with much of the country over the past year, to the point now where there are wide stretches of the country, say in the north, which are just not under government control. And even the vicious attack of the regime on the city of Homs, which had gone out of its control, and which is a city of 1 million people, it's a major city in the center of the country, the diversion of so many troops and tanks there for this assault on the city has meant that some of the rest of the country has gone completely out of control. So the regime is kind of playing a game of whack-a-mole. It's not been able to put this thing down.
So what is your prognosis? What do you think is going to happen here? Is it only a matter of time?
I would say that it's a matter of time. It seems to me that when a regime faces this degree of widespread discontent and when it alienates so much of its population and can really only rule by main force, when you're to the point where you're sending... recently, the regime was sending tanks into two cities at once. If that's the only way you can stay in power, you've lost authority. You may have power, but you've lost authority. And that's going to work itself out one way or another. The economy is paralyzed. The business people in Damascus aren't making any money. You have to ask yourself, at what point does the rest of the elite in Syria say, well, these guys just aren't doing a very good job here. We have to get rid of them so that the country can move on. Mm-hmm. So the most likely denouement, the most likely end of this thing would be some kind of coup at the top.
So, Mansour, as you talk to people in the region, now you don't poll in Syria, do you, or do you?
Well, we had just completed a pilot study. We are going to launch a survey in the next couple of weeks in Syria.
But as you talk to people in countries around Syria, what is the reaction to this? Now you have it spilling over into Lebanon, I see, in the last couple of weeks. You mentioned Jordan. How are folks outside of Syria viewing what's happening in Syria?
One of the fascinating aspects of the Arab Spring is the activation of the Arab League from a basically incompetent, inefficient institution into something credible. That, you know, the Arab public in general are in support of the movement in Syria. You know, we should about 70% of the Syrian population belong to Sunni Islam, so there is considerable support for the Syrian among the Arab public. Even when the Islamic Republic invited a group of people from Arab countries in order to celebrate so-called Islamic awakening, there were people among the audience who carried pro-Syrian sign that the regime was not able to silence, and it was quite an embarrassment for it, you know, to see that these people from other Arab country came and now defending the Syrian movement against Bashar Assad.
Mm-hmm.
The forces that are in favor, in support of the regime, of course, are those who are tied to the Islamic regime, primarily the Islamic Republic of Iran, that reportedly provide weapon and also cash, as much as recently $1 billion, as well as the Hezbollah. They are heavily involved in helping the Syrian regime to crack down on the opposition. And also, of course, the Russian, you know, who are supporting. But the Russian are doing this opportunistically. In my view, they want to be taken a little bit more seriously in international politics. So if they get a little bit more credit from the West, from Europe and the United States, they may change position in Syria.
Well, let me ask you about that one. Mm-hmm. You've got Russia and China being willing to play the shield in the United Nations. Isn't this dicey for them, or is it something that they can do with relative ease and little consequence?
I think it's a big change in world affairs. We haven't seen Russia and China play this kind of role in blocking the U.S. In recent years. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, you had about 20 years there where the U.S. could pretty much do whatever it wanted, and you saw that there weren't strong Russian or Chinese objections to the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, for instance. But they're putting their feet down. I think it's partly that both Russia and China are reemerging as great powers in their own right. The Chinese now have the world's second largest economy. They're planning to build an aircraft carrier. They've got economic and political interests in Africa, Latin America, and so forth. So they're just starting to act like a great power, which has interests, which are not the same as the U.S. interests. And the Russians, likewise, under Putin, trying to revive their nationalism, as Mansour said, and they both China and Russia are pretty immune to U.S. pressure. In fact, the U.S. owes China money rather than the other way around, and the high oil and gas prices have given Putin a new platform for world influence. Well, the Russians have a naval base on the Mediterranean in Syria that's leased to them by the Syrian regime. They sell $4 billion a year in weaponry to Syria. Syria is an old-time Soviet client, which Putin, I think, is trying to pick back up as a Russian client now. So he's playing great power politics, but he has, you know, economic and military interests in Syria, which would go by the boards were a completely different party and group to take over Syria. You couldn't be sure that they'd continue to license that base, naval base, to the Russians. And it's the only Mediterranean naval base the Russians have. So I think there are specific reasons for which Russia is running interference for the Ba'ath regime. China, I think, it doesn't have so many interests in Syria, but it just doesn't like the idea of NATO taking over everything. Both China and Russia felt that the NATO and Western Europe and the United States took advantage of the UN Security Council resolution on a no-fly zone over Libya to do regime change in Libya and then to turn Libya into a Western client. And China and Russia had big investments in the Libyan oil industry, which are now, you know, in doubt. Mm-hmm. So they just don't want a repeat of Libya in Syria. And the reason they rejected the recently proposed Security Council resolution was that it called for Bashar al-Assad to step down.
So it called for regime change.
It, Russia and China were afraid that could be interpreted as a call for regime change.
Today I am talking with my guests, EMU Professor Mansour Mwadel and U of M Professor Juan Cole. We're talking about events and attitudes in the Middle East. Juan, I want to turn to you for a minute to talk about Iran. Now, this is, you know, there are lots of things happening, but in the U.S., while we're watching Syria, while we're watching other kinds of things, Iran is very much in the forefront of our thinking, a nearly nuclear power, at least that's our concern. There's a lot of stuff going on there. I want to ask you first about if you know anything about the progress they're making with nuclear weapons, any information on that you have?
Well, I'm a skeptic on the nuclear issue with regard to Iran. I don't think they want a nuclear warhead. I think they do want a breakout capability. I think they want to be in a position, sort of the way Japan is, that if they thought somebody was trying to invade them, that they could fairly quickly construct a bomb, that they would have the know-how and so forth. But the national intelligence estimates of the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies in 2007 and 2010 both said that they assessed with fair certainty that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. And Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta reaffirmed this position recently. So the intelligence professionals agree that Iran has a civilian nuclear enrichment program aimed at making fuel for its reactors. But they don't agree that there is a weapons program. You know, if you enrich to 3.5%, you've got fuel for an ordinary reactor. If you enrich uranium to 19.75%, you've got fuel for a special kind of reactor that produces medical isotopes, and they have such a reactor, and they say that they've just taken it hot and put in fuel rods for it, that they were able to enrich to 19.75%. But to make a bomb, you have to enrich to 95%.
Mm-hmm.
And Iran is under inspection. The United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency inspects Iranian nuclear facilities regularly and has certified in its most recent report that no uranium has been diverted to military uses. It can't find plutonium signatures, or the inspectors have ways of knowing if somebody's trying to make a bomb. So I think there's a lot of hype around the Iranian nuclear program. Under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, to which Iran is a signatory, it has the right to enrich uranium for fuel purposes for reactors. And as far as anybody can tell, that's all they're doing at the moment. Now, the fear is that at any moment they may change their minds and go for broke to get a bomb. And they're now in a position where they could plausibly do that, but they'd have to kick out the inspectors, they'd have to develop secret facilities, and we don't have evidence that they're doing any of that. In fact, we know that they haven't kicked out the inspectors. With regard to the U.S. And Israeli position towards Iran, I think what's really going on is that they don't want Iran to have a breakout capability. They don't want it even to be able to close the fuel cycle, to be in a position where in the future it might decide to go for a bomb. I think they all know that Iran does not have presently a weapons program.
Let me turn to Professor Mwadel. You're out there assessing public opinion. What do Iranians feel? What do their neighbors feel about this nuclear effort?
I beg to differ just a bit with my good friend Juan. The leaders of the Islamic Republic are pathological liar. You know, they kill people, rape political prisoners, and deny it. You know, even when they murder Neda on daylight in front of millions to see, they said that we didn't do it. It was the British who did it. The propaganda machine is beyond imagination. There are, of course, unfortunately, one or two the Iranian who bought into the discourse of the Islamic regime that the program is for peaceful purpose. They have this program secretly for over 20 years, and they put the country in a cause considerable economic difficulty for the countries, isolated the country internationally. for the sake of science and getting, you know, getting access to scientific technology of nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, I seriously doubt it. You know, I mean, the regime has come to the realization that the best way that they protect them in the same way that North Korea have done is that to have access to a nuclear bomb in order to, you know, have a guarantee for the entire system. So the notion that this regime is not having a plan for building a bomb is a little bit optimistic, in my view.
Well, so how do the neighbors feel about this? Is this disconcerting, or is it just essentially the same old thing, which is you have religious factions, and that's what makes people uncomfortable?
Well, that is the other side of the problem, is that even from the strictly from the Iranian national interest, what the regime is doing is doing something against that, because the closest the Islamic Republic get to having access to the technology of making the bomb, the more nervous all the neighbors become, like, you know, the Turk, the Saudis, Egyptian. And for a region that has the history of political instability and political violence and terrorism, this direction is very, very dangerous, you know, to the people of the entire region. So the particularly the Persian Gulf countries are quite concerned about what is happening in Iran. So I mean, they would be very happy to see that this regime is overthrown.
Listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show. You're listening here on 89.1 WEMU. Today we are talking about events and attitudes in the Middle East, and my guests are U of M History Professor Juan Cole, EMU Sociology Professor Mansour Madel. And I want to turn to you, Juan, about at least one of Iran's neighbors, and that's Israel. And clearly Israel is very concerned about this. There has been there have been a number of assassinations of people working within the nuclear industry in Iran or in the nuclear effort. Some people are pointing to Israel as the likely culprit here. Do you think that's true?
Oh, I don't think there's very much doubt about it. There have been a number of Iranian nuclear physicists who have been assassinated. They likely were assassinated by members of the terrorist group, the Mujahideen Khalq, or the People's Holy Warriors, who have a behind-the-scenes alliance with Israeli intelligence.
Is this MEK?
Yes. Mm. And who are very powerful in the United States. They have given money to many congresspeople, and they've got everybody from Howard Dean to Rudy Giuliani going to their conferences. Even though they're on the State Department terrorist list, they've been responsible for large numbers of bombings and assassinations inside Iran. Saddam Hussein used them for this purpose. So, I mean, a U.S. official actually slipped up and recently admitted that it was very likely that the Israelis and the MEK were behind the assassination of the scientists. You know, that's, I think, more symbolic than anything else. It's not as if they can kill enough of the Iranian scientists to stop the program. It's just sending a message to stop. And the other thing that the U.S. and Israel are doing are orchestrating financial sanctions on the regime. They've basically attempted to disconnect the Iranian finance and banking system from that of the rest of the world, which makes it extremely difficult for Iran's customers who buy its petroleum or who sell Iran automobiles and other made goods to exchange money for these things. So,
well, doesn't that drive Iran right into the arms of Russia and China?
Oh, yes. Well, China and India in particular are Iran's biggest trade partners now. And both of them are trying to find ways around the U.S. sanctions. They recently announced that that Iran will pay for things in gold from India and China. Iran will accept rupees in payment for its petroleum, Indian rupees, and So there, in my view, given the high oil prices, there's more demand in the world for petroleum than there is petroleum. The likelihood that you could actually have a world boycott on Iranian petroleum that would devastate the government, you could hurt the people, but to devastate the government seems to me highly unlikely. Basically, you'd have to put 2.5 million barrels a day of petroleum, which is what Iran exports, on the world market beyond what the demand is. And we're very far from doing that. In fact, the prices are high now. So I personally think these boycotts and financial sanctions hurt Iran. It raises the cost of doing business and so forth, but they're not fatal to the regime. There are workarounds around them, and the regime is going still to get a lot of money for its petroleum. I think it's very unlikely that it will cause the regime to cease attempting to enrich uranium for these reactors. We have a friendly disagreement, Mansour and I. I don't think we can know what their ultimate intent is, and I think there's danger for them in going the North Korea route and actually making a bomb and blowing it up, because, of course, North Koreans have trouble getting food. The international sanctions are so severe. I think the Iranian regime just wants the capability. I don't think they actually want to blow up a bomb or to construct a physical one. But I think if they thought they were going to be invaded, they might. Mm-hmm. The idea that you could stop their program by bombing it is silly. They're using centrifuges. They have thousands of them. They don't all have to be in one place. You could set back the program, but you likely would simply convince them that, well, they'd better hurry things up.
Right. Let me turn to Dr. Mwadel. Is there anything to suggest that the beginnings of an uprising like we saw in Egypt and Tunisia, is there any chance that that's going to happen in Iran? Any indications that it's beginning?
It is hard to tell what is going to happen in Iran in the next few years. But what is clear to me, at least based on anecdotal evidence, is that, you know, the people on the top are divided. You know, there is a conflict between Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic, and Ahmadinejad. And the public is in the extent of dissatisfaction among the public is extensive. What benefited Ahmadinejad in the past several years is the increase in the oil price. So if this sanction is effective and it just removes these important sources of revenue for some time, they won't be able to pay for the mobilization of the public. Some of the besieges that I happen to know inside Iran, they were the ones who are being paid to beat up the demonstrators. They are not ideologically committed to the regime. But I wanted to add one point about this assassination of the Iranian technician scientist. I believe that this is whoever is behind it, so I do not question the fact that it may be the Israelis. This is counterproductive. It has provoked sort of Iranian nationalism, not for the regime, but for the sympathy of the family of the scientists who were murdered. And it is ineffective. This kind of terrorist activities is not going to really affect considerably the policy of the Islamic regime. Unfortunately, less so now than in the past, there has been a disconnect between the demand of the international community regarding the Islamic Republic nuclear policy and the Iranian public, who really would like to have a responsive government, democracy, economic prosperity. So if the Western government put equal emphasis on defending human rights, equality among the citizens, defending the political prisoners. Now there are tens of political prisoners who have engaged in hunger strike against the regime. Defending those people, this is another weakness of the regime that may contribute to the moderation.
You know. I want to thank both of you for being with me today. It's been wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thank you
for having me.
Thanks for having us on. Mm-hmm.
My guest today, EMU Professor Mansur Madel and U of M History Professor Juan Cole. I want to thank them both for being here. And listeners, please join me next week for another edition of the Lynn Rivers Show, when we'll talk about the news, politics, history, or a mixture thereof. Radio that makes you think. The Lynn Rivers Show, right here on 89.1 WEMU.